Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. Campaign number 2, the 14th Colony, the Quebec Campaign. We pick up the story with the campaign of the Americans to invade Canada, to hopefully sway the Canadian people to join the American side. The American forces, led by General Benedict Arnold and General Richard Montgomery, amass outside of Quebec City at the end of 1775. British Governor Guy Carleton commanded the British forces inside the city. Quebec City was well prepared for the coming onslaught of the Americans. The main city, Uppertown, was protected by imposing western stone walls facing the Plains of Abraham. Fortifications protected remaining approaches up steep hillsides in other directions. On the riverfront below, to the northeast, Lower Town was far more exposed, a narrow strip of merchant stores and warehouses, but defenders had barricaded both ends. British sentries kept regular watch, and men slept on arms, ready to scramble to rallying points upon alarm. American General Richard Montgomery weighed different attack options against the city, but focused his New Year's Eve effort on Lower Town. It was a more practical objective, and if its valuable trade goods were at risk by capture, citizens might demand the entire city's surrender. But the general was desperate, steeling himself with a proverb, "Fortune favors the brave." General Montgomery split his force into three independent columns. Livingston and Brown would make feints against Upper Town, while Benedict Arnold and Montgomery led separate assaults on Lower Town, from north and south, respectively. Around 4 in the morning on New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1775, Continentals shuffled through steep drifts toward assembly points in a near whiteout. Quebec City sentries sounded the alarm after spotting traces of light through the blizzard on the Plains of Abraham below the city, and Livingston's Canadian Continentals approached a set of blaze at St. John's Gate, but withdrew under musket and cannon fire. Brown's men shot at the Cape Diamond Bastion, but never left their initial positions. The British defenders soon saw that this was not the main American effort. Unobserved by defenders above, American General Montgomery led his New Yorkers along the icy riverside road below Cape Diamond. The general led from the front, clearing Lower Town's first barricades uncontested. Then, as he called for help removing the next barriers, cannon fire flashed from a house. Montgomery, his aide, and six soldiers were killed by grapeshot. Shocked by their brave leader's death, and challenged by seemingly formidable defenses, the senior American colonel withdrew rather than pressing ahead. The southern attack was over. Benedict Arnold's column started a little late, missing the signal rocket in the blowing snow. As his men moved beyond St. Roch, Upper Town, British defenders fired down, striking Arnold with a serious leg wound. He tried to carry on, but heavy bleeding forced him back to the hospital. Intrepid Kennebec Expedition veterans drove into Lower Town, and the battle quickly devolved into ferocious house-to-house fighting. Captain Morgan led a drive that took some barricades and threatened the heart of the town. British Governor General Carleton, however, discerned that this was the only fight and sent 100 men out Palace Gate at dawn. Attacked in the rear, the American Continentals briefly fought on until it became clear that they were unmistakably trapped and outnumbered. After the rebels reluctantly surrendered, British and Loyalist defenders rounded up 372 prisoners and 33 wounded. 35 of Benedict Arnold's men lay dead in Lower Town streets and buildings. Despite the resounding victory, Carleton held to his plan and remained behind Quebec City's walls to wait for either the rebels or winter to break. After Montgomery's demise, Benedict Arnold took every practical measure to sustain the Quebec City blockade with the Army's weak remnants. He requested immediate reinforcements from his new superior, Brigadier General David Wooster, in Montreal, but they refused to send him. Despite the circumstances, surprising numbers of Canadians responded to Arnold's local appeals for supplies and men to join the blockade against the British. Even though Carleton's troops remained inside Quebec City, Arnold's army faced another deadly enemy, smallpox. The first cases appeared in early December, and Montgomery had already established a smallpox hospital to isolate victims. Yet many soldiers inoculated themselves against orders, taking the disease with less deadly symptoms, but often inadvertently spreading it as a result. Up to half of Arnold's men were sick with smallpox and unavailable for duty at any time. Meanwhile, Wooster remained back in Montreal to secure lines of communication for the Americans while appealing near and far for immediate reinforcements. Lacking meaningful occupational guidance, he improvised policies, vainly trying to placate friendly Canadians and suppress loyalist agitators. With great controversy, he banned annual fur trade shipments to the Great Lakes. While those wares could be used to encourage Indians to join the British in the West, they were also Montreal's economic lifeblood. Far and away in Philadelphia, Congress had been slow to address Northern American Army needs from the beginning. Despite General Schuyler and Montgomery's repeated appeals in the fall for troops, money, and supplies, Congress waited until January 1776 to authorize six additional regiments for Quebec. Combined with troops still in Canada, they only totaled about half of General Schuyler's 10,000-man recommendation. The American Quebec City camp suffered at the end of a fragile 600-mile logistics chain that failed to meet basic needs. Since Canadians refused to take Continental paper money, General Arnold resorted to unpopular requisitions to feed his men. In mid-January, word of General Montgomery's tragic defeat at the Battle of Quebec City distressed the United Colonies, but Congress still dithered. It waited months to appoint a new commander, Major General John Thomas, and a much-needed congressional commission to deliver Patriot political leadership assistance to Canada. As a result, the commander and the commissioners traveled north during the spring thaw and arrived far too late. At the end of April, Wooster finally joined the Quebec City siege, and General Arnold, now a lieutenant general, left for Montreal. Wooster struggled to keep soldiers in camp until properly replaced, sometimes past their enlistments. Yet when Major General Thomas finally reached the camp on May 2nd, he found just 2,000 men, half on the sick rolls. Brigadier General William Thompson was on the way with a 2,000-man brigade from Cambridge, but was still hundreds of miles away. So on May 5th, 1776, General Thomas made a difficult decision to abandon the untenable siege of Quebec City. That very night, signal fires warned that British ships were coming up the St. Lawrence River. British Governor General Carleton had patiently awaited relief. Over winter, British leaders responded to Canadian setbacks with pragmatic determination. In just a few months, they assembled a 10,000-man expedition under General John Burgoyne, and its first wave crossed the Atlantic early enough to venture up the St. Lawrence River as soon as river ice was cleared away. The first five British vessels reached Quebec City on the morning of May 6 and properly unloaded British soldiers. By noon, General Carleton led almost 900 men out to drive off the already disordered American enemy. Americans fled in panic, leaving weapons, supplies, and sick comrades. Carleton's troops gathered up abandoned, incapacitated rebels, but made no immediate pursuit of the Americans. Initially, General Thomas hoped to halt the American flight north of the St. Maurice River, but the army was too disorganized and ill-supplied. After a 125-mile retreat, officers restored order at Sorel. The army established a fortified camp there, hoping to hold the Richelieu Valley and Montreal. Back at Montreal, American continental leaders had long been warned that British troops and Indians were preparing an attack from the west. In late April, Arnold responded by ordering a regiment-sized force of New Hampshire and Connecticut reinforcements to build a fort in the westernmost parish of the Cedars to control western approaches on the St. Lawrence River. 160 Iroquois and Missisquoi warriors gathered at the British fort Osotecha, 125 miles west of Montreal. Encouraged by loyalists and Indian department officers, they aimed to attack the American rebels around Montreal for many reasons, including a desire to restore the trade good flows on the St. Lawrence River that was being blocked by the Americans. On May 14, 1776, the Indian force headed downriver along with Otsego's Redcoat Garrison Company. 107 nations of Canada's warriors joined the expedition as it approached the Continentals at Fort Cedars. On May 18th, more than 200 Indians, 40 British, and some Canadian loyalists attacked that fort. Its commander, terrified of savages and suffering from smallpox, surrendered with 400 men the next day. On May 20th, an Indian and loyalist detachment met and ambushed a fatally delayed American Continental Relief column. The 100 Americans suffered a couple dozen battle casualties in an hour-long fight. They surrendered when their retreat path was blocked, having killed just one Indian and wounding two. The 500 combined American prisoners were pillaged and tormented by their native Indian captors for a week. Despite his prisoner burden, the British commander proceeded on towards Montreal until General Arnold threatened to counterattack with superior numbers on May 24th. The Indians and British withdrew as the Continentals lagged in pursuit. 2 days later, the captain negotiated a controversial prisoner exchange cartel with Arnold, saving captors' lives while giving Indians and Redcoats safe retreat. The Cedars affair was a highly embarrassing American defeat. Meanwhile, General Carleton's army moved slowly upriver. Following a strategic hearts and minds approach, General Carleton sought to spare rebel soldiers so they could return home in defeat, spreading tales of the king's generosity and gross American continental incompetence. As a result, the British advanced just 80 miles by land and river in a month, half the distance to Montreal. The Continental Army recovering at Sorel was vexed by familiar problems, inadequate supplies, smallpox, poor discipline, and a lack of hard money. Command was further complicated as General Thomas succumbed to smallpox, leaving Worcester, Arnold, and Thompson to conditionally lead the army. On June 1st, the winds of war seemed to shift when Brigadier General John Sullivan reached Fort St. John's with another brigade from George Washington's main army. As a senior brigadier, Sullivan took command. Soldier spirits improved at Sorel, and local Canadian support resurged. Then on June 6th, General Sullivan received promising intelligence of 300 British soldiers exposed at the head of General Carleton's advance in Trois Rivières along the St. Maurice River. Late the next night, General Thompson and 1,600 men crossed the St. Lawrence River to attack Trois Rivières and stem the British advance. The general led his troops inland to avoid observation by British warships, but they became disorientated and misrouted that night on swampy, wooded pass. The advance guard did not reach Trois Rivières' outskirts until dawn on June 8th. British redcoats sounded the alarm and manned defensive works outside the city to fend off the rebel advance guard. unbeknownst to General Thompson, over the past couple days, the British had brought 2,000 troops to Trois-Rivières. With supporting fire from Royal Navy ships, those regulars efficiently routed the disorganized Continentals, driving them into the woods. The British suffered about 20 casualties, and a few dozen Americans were killed or wounded. Over the next few days, Loyalist Canadians and Indians brought more than 200 prisoners from the woods, including General Thompson. With humiliations at the Cedars and Trois-Rivières, General Sullivan abandoned American hope for Canada. On June 11th, the army withdrew from Sorel, and 4 days later, General Arnold left Montreal. On June 18th, Sullivan began moving the entire army back to Crown Point, New York, to recover and defend the 13 colonies at the other end of Lake Champlain. The retreat was complete on July 1st, 1776. The Northern Army's retreat essentially guaranteed that Carleton would attack in the summer of 1776, but Continental leaders took important steps to delay that prospect. The Army left no intact watercraft for the British to use on Lake Champlain in northern New York. Carleton had to assemble a new navy at Fort St. John's while the Americans built their own ships in a summer naval construction race. In early October, General Carleton finally advanced with a superior British fleet. General Arnold skillfully contested British Lake superiority with a Continental Navy squadron, eventually incurring a tactical naval defeat at Valcour Bay on October 11th and 12th, 1776. However, General Arnold strategically delayed the British advance long enough that British General Carleton decided it was too late in the season to continue on to Crown Point and Fort Ticonderoga on Lake Champlain. The British Army went back to Canada. The British invasion was postponed until 1777, buying the struggling American Continental cause valuable time. In the summer of 1776, the Continental Congress assigned a committee to review the Quebec campaign disaster. Its report identified three principal causes for the American defeat. The first was short enlistments. General Montgomery was compelled to attack Quebec City before his army disappeared, and he and Generals Worcester and Arnold repeatedly remade and improvised an army on campaign. Second was a want of hard money. The colonies simply lacked sufficient hard currency to pay for army requirements in a remote land that would not accept continental paper. Last was smallpox, which kept one quarter to half the army on the sick rolls all throughout 1776. Despite these findings, the campaign's core failures were truly rooted in Philadelphia. Overconfident in the power of revolutionary zeal and virtue, Congress had approved an invasion into Canada with insufficient thought to the requisite forces, supplies, and finances. Quebec proved the limits of the 13 colonies' strategic reach. They lacked the wealth of imperial resources and military expertise that Great Britain had used to conquer the same province back in 1759 and 1760. Even if American General Montgomery or Arnold had managed to take Quebec City, Britain's naval superiority and vast means, as well as Canada's near-total economic dependence on the St. Lawrence River, meant that the British King's forces would inevitably have retaken the entire province if desired. Still, Congress never completely abandoned hope that Canadians would join the American Continental Confederation. Common historical analysis often asserts that French Catholic inhabitants never would have supported the American patriot cause because of seemingly insurmountable historic, ethnic, and religious differences. Yet during the invasion, military, economic, and geographic realities seemed to be far more significant factors. The 1775 to 76 campaign demonstrated that, like many other colonies, Canada had active loyalist and patriot factions, even as the largest segment of the population generally sought to avoid active commitment. In 1776, British Governor General Carleton saved the province by holding Quebec City until relieved. But his most important contribution may have been made after the province was recovered. Carleton deliberately restored order and reasserted control with generous, balanced policies that minimized future dissent. His hearts and minds approach with rebel invaders did not pay off as well, though, given time, distance, and the shocks of the 1777 invasion. Many Canadian campaign veterans returned to the patriot cause with vigor. The Quebec campaign further challenged the short war myth popular on both sides of the Atlantic. Instead of shrinking from their bloodying at Lexington, Concord, and Bunker Hill, the Americans launched an offensive that almost took Canada. Similarly, even when the northern province appeared to have fallen to the rebels, the British King and Parliament did not opt for reconciliation. The British responded with even greater military commitment and ruthless punitive policies that included loosening restraints on Native American allied warfare. In the colonies, defeat in Canada persuaded many American leaders that they ultimately required foreign assistance, financial, material, and military. Since European powers were more likely to assist a new nation rather than rebellious colonies, the campaign encouraged those inclined to independence and helped prompt the birth of the United States just 3 days after the Canadian invasion concluded. This concludes the essay on Campaign Number 2, the 14th Colony, the Quebec Campaign. Campaign number 3 in the 10 key campaigns of the American Revolution. All London was afloat. The New York Campaign, Phase 1, August to September 1776. For those who awoke early in the morning of July 1st, 1776, there was a light breeze in Lower Manhattan, New York. Residents who wandered out towards the tip of the island likely could not see far into the harbor on that foggy Monday. Hugh Gaines, New York Gazette newspaper, and the Weekly Mercury newspaper for that day offered only the slightest clue that something momentous stood just offshore. Buried toward the bottom of the New York byline for that day in the newspapers was a simple matter-of-fact sentence. The number of transports now at Sandy Hook, we hear, amounts to 113 sail. And we have not the reason to doubt that General Howe is in this fleet. Daniel McCurtain, a recently discharged Maryland soldier in the city, summed it up much better when he saw the massive British fleet off the New Jersey shore. In about 10 minutes, the whole bay was full of shipping, as ever it could be. I declared that I thought all London was afloat. The war that started outside Boston in April 1775 had finally come to New York City. That a British fleet started arriving off Sandy Hook at the end of June should not have been a surprise to most people. When the British Army in America under General William Howe evacuated Boston on March 17th, it did not signal an end to the conflict with the rebels, but merely that the scene of war would be moving elsewhere. British General Howe and the army regrouped in Halifax, Nova Scotia, awaiting large numbers of reinforcements before opening the campaign. The British would be stretched thin. Troops were required in Canada, which was then under siege from an invading American army, and also to launch an expedition to strike at the southern colonies, principally Charleston, South Carolina. New York made perfect sense as the next British target. The harbor would be an excellent base for the Royal Navy. Loyalists were said to be far more common there than in New England, and the rivers and waterways would make defense by Washington's troops problematic, given their lack of a naval force. The extensive coastline provided the British with every advantage in terms of mobility. British General Howe's troops, about 9,000 in number, included some Highlanders newly arrived from Scotland, and they left Halifax on June 10th, convoyed by Royal Navy warships. Over the next month, the army would grow in size and diversity. Many of the Scottish Highlanders arrived off Sandy Hook below New York in 7 transports on July 21st. On August 1st, Howe's second in command, General Henry Clinton, arrived with General Charles Earl Cornwallis at the head of 2,900 British troops, including a company of Loyalist Black Pioneers recruited in North Carolina. The fleet accompanying them consisted of 50 ships under British Admiral Sir Peter Parker. Parker and General Clinton had lately conducted a failed campaign to capture Charleston, South Carolina. On August 12th, 1,000 men drawn from the elite British Brigade of Guards arrived, along with the 1st Division of Hessian troops, about 7,800 men, under the command of Lieutenant General Leopold von Heister. The fleet brought these regiments consisted of some 107 transports, store ships, and warships. A ragtag assortment of British and Loyalist troops from Virginia, the debris of forces once serving under Royal Governor Lord Dunmore, and some very weak British regiments from the West Indies rounded out the British Army, now totaling around 24,000 men under General Howe. It would be ready to commence operations against the Americans by the third week in August. Reading from the third campaign, All London Was Afloat, in the 10 key campaigns of the American Revolution will be continued. This is Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio. Then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.